Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio. Late. Sorry, folks. This is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Yeah, we turned in at 7:20.
And we were supposed to connect with Rockin' Rodney about 20 minutes ago, so I'm hoping he's forgiving when we call him now. But I had some major difficulties getting my computer to work properly tonight, and I was late anyway. But I had a good excuse. My horseback riding today, the date.
It was funny. I was going to lay down. I'm like, dude, if I lay down, I'm going to fall dead asleep.
Well, we'll try to get Rodney on here, make this happen here. But we got a lot to talk about otherwise. We got a lot of fight stuff happening. Already happened. I didn't really get to watch much boxing over the weekend, but there was...
I don't think there was much boxing over the weekend. I think there was really just fights on Tuesday night.
Right. Tuesday night fights, yeah, that's getting to be every week now they're going to do that, so...
It is every week, and I'm excited about it. I like it. I'm all for it.
Well, while I'm waiting for this stuff to load, Rodney, by the way, Rodney Moore, Rockin' Rodney Moore, he's 38-10-2, he's a professional boxer, he's retired now, he's 20 KOs. He was undefeated for 5.5 years until his first world title fight, and he's also got a great program, after-school program, called Fight to Learn, so we're going to chat with him a little bit later. As soon as I get his number into the system, hopefully he will be patient with us. Okay, so contacts. Save a phone number. Here we go. Rockin', and he's not the only Rockin' Rodney, by the way. He's another Rockin' Rodney, but he spelled it R-O-C-K-I-N-G.
Like rocking.
Oops, what is it? No, it's not that. I punch in his number and it gives me Matt Yanofsky home. No, I'll call him Matt.
What?
Why do you keep changing the name? Come on, add the damn number. This is really pissing me off now.
Well, Peter, Chris.
Okay, let's try this again. Matt Yanofsky at home. I guess I'm going to have to call Matt Yanofsky at home.
Okay. He always loves to hear from us.
Fucking anything. He messaged him. Oh, shit. Come on, Skype. Cooperate with me here for a minute, please.
Good luck with that.
Okay. Matt Yanofsky at home. Let's see if it gave me that. There we go. We're going to call him Matt now. Rockin' Rodney. His name is Matt.
We're sorry. The person you are calling does not wish to talk with callers who dropped their number. If you wish to reach this person, please hang up and place your call again without blocking your number. We're sorry.
Well, that's
the person you are calling does not wish to talk with callers who blocked their number. If you wish to reach this person, please hang up and place your call again without blocking your number.
Yep. Oh, I gotta give them a phone. 7224-243-228. Okay. So he has to call us. It ain't one thing, it's another.
No, it is.
Okay, so we'll wait for Rodney to call in. While we're waiting for him, I do want to mention Bellator had a big...
Would you text him?
I sent him an email. He had just emailed me what's going on, so...
Oh, okay.
3 minutes ago. So he's waiting for us, so now he knows he's got to call in. So we'll wait for him to call in, and I don't know if Tom's listening or not. I got an email from Tom I got to return to. Thank
you. You got what, dental surgery?
Thank you, slow computer. Anyway, we'll get Tom on, hopefully.
Yeah, he said if he can talk, he had his dental surgery.
Oh, is that what the message was?
Yeah.
I didn't get it yet, so fill me in. You got
dental surgery. So he said he sounds like Daffy Duck or something like that, or Donald Duck or some duck.
Oh.
Howard the Duck, I don't know.
Or he wants to skip tonight?
Well, he said he's going to try to call in to see how he has his, if he's able to talk.
Okay.
Well, it's yawning.
It's a good thing we're good talkers.
I'm a good talker? Really? Thank you.
You do a good job.
I'm usually so quiet and reserved.
Now, speaking of talking, you like to talk about this guy, Tyson Fury.
I love his name.
A little more than talking the other day. He did a Batman stunt. Did you hear about this?
I did not hear the whole story. I heard he did something.
You know, supposedly, you know, he's going to fight Klitschko. That's not supposedly. It's happening. So, Klitschko have a big press conference. And sure enough, here comes Tyson Fury. As if the name is not enough, he comes out dressed as Batman. Then the Joker runs in, and he beats up the Joker in front of everybody. And, of course, Vladimir Klitschko is looking at this like, oh, my God, this is like, what's his name, Shannon Briggs all over.
Yeah.
Like, why do I got to deal with all these crazy people? I just got that look on his face at the podium. I saw the video of it. It's, like, so funny. I just cannot believe it's happening right in front of him like this, you know. And a lot of people said he was really disrespectful, too, on top of everything else, the stunt and all that. Really, really disrespectful, but at the same time, he says, yeah, I'm just trying to sell a fight here, you know, everybody does that shit. So, anyway, it was...
In Tyson Fury, you can really take him one of two ways, to be honest. I mean, I've seen, you know, some of the things he said. I remember when he was fighting Steve Cunningham, and apparently they've become, you know, cordial, at least, because I know Cunningham's going to spar with him a couple times after they fought 2 years ago. But I remember Fury, like, in the press conference was, like, spouting off, and he's almost sounding like racial or whatever, like, oh, what do you think, you're from the hood or something? You, what do you think you, like, I forget, like, his exact words, but he was trying to, like, you know, because, like, you know, Cunningham being, you know, a black guy from Philadelphia is like a thug, like a hoodlum. And anybody that knows Steve Cunningham knows he's anything but. He's one of the most positive guys out there. But Fury was really racially charged in that one, which I thought was inappropriate and ridiculous. And
hello?
Then he's acting up with this one, too. Hello?
Hold that thought. We have Rodney, I believe.
Yeah, this Rodney Moore on the phone.
How's it going, Rodney? Sorry about being late tonight.
Hey, guys, how y'all doing, man?
I'm doing good.
Doing great, Rodney. Always love to talk to a fellow Philadelphian.
Hey, I got to say I apologize because I didn't know that, you know, I thought you guys was trying to reach out to me, but I noticed on the email you guys said you couldn't get through. So, you know, I don't know what happened, but we must have had some kind of disconnect there. But I'm certainly happy to be on as we speak.
Awesome. Well, we got a lot of questions for you. I'd love to talk about not only your career, but I think most importantly what you're doing now. It's a great thing, a fight to learn. Tell us a little bit more about how that got started and what you do with that.
Well, after my long 17-year pro career, you know, I just wanted to do something different than most, you know, fighters do after their career is over. And that's to give back to children. I mean, what better thing can you do, you know, than to try to enhance our children's academic achievements and, you know, try to prepare them for the world, you know, as far as education. And you know, 2001, I decided to put together a program, and, you know, the organization got going in 2003. Took 2 years, you know, to get everything, you know, right with the state, with the RS, and then we were legally able to ready to start running that fight to learn. And, you know, I have to just say I give all credit, you know, to the board of directors, because the organization could have never made it to this level without the board of directors. I mean, naturally, the board is the leadership, you know, that directs the organization to make sure that we accomplish its missions. And the board is myself as the board chair and CEO. We have DeVita Gar, Robina Moore, Robert Beck Jr., and Dave Wilkes. We're the board that got the program going, and our number one mission, you know, is to make sure that we provide a learning environment for at-risk boys and girls ages 5 to 12. We appeal to their hearts, to their minds, you know, especially those who come from low to moderate income families. We do this by preparing them for healthy, productive futures in an increasingly challenging 21st century society and workplace. You know, so we just try to provide components that's just going to help enhance them and just prepare them for teen years in adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
And Rodney, I remember reading an article when this program was first getting some publicity a couple of years ago. They did a synopsis on it in Ring Magazine. And I remember one of the things you said in there was, you know, you have a lot of these kids, especially, you know, like as you said, the lower, you know, moderate income, you know, family that maybe, you know, can't afford a computer at the house or can't afford, you know, educational resources at the house for these kids. And this is, you know, a good way to keep them, you know, from hanging out on that street corner or, you know, a self-destructive type of lifestyle. It's giving them something productive and it's helping them build for a future and, you know, better prepare themselves, you know, for a career one day, and, you know, not just a labor type of career, but the type of career where they're using their minds.
Well, you know, that was the whole dream. You know, I go back to thinking when I was a child, you know, before the program, you know, was even thought of. I thought of, you know, us not having as many opportunities as there's opportunity today. And I go back to think, you know, in school, I wasn't a quick learner. I wasn't a guy who, you know, would catch on to things real fast. So I think of the children that was in the same position as me, you know, or a step or two behind me. And, you know, when you in school with those kind of children that's more far advanced, it become an embarrassing situation. And you get to a point where you stop raising your hand because you didn't want to get called all kind of crazy names because you took, you know, a longer time to, you know, catch up to what was happening. And, you know, today it's totally different. You know, it makes kids, you know, definitely lose their esteem. It takes away their confidence, you know, and it's to a point where they go home not learning the lesson because they're afraid to continuously raise their hand to go through the embarrassment of getting called all kind of names. So I look at those children at the same way that I was, and I thought that an after-school program, number one, being a smaller setting, and, you know, when you have a 8-to-1, a 10-to-1 ratio, you know, you have a group of kids where they're not 40 children or 50 children in the classroom. that, you know, where you don't have to, you know, pretty much almost like embarrass yourself because of being put in that position of raising your hand where the whole classroom can hear, you know, the constant questions that you're asking. So, you know, after school programs is so important for children, not only to, you know, get them prepared academically, but, you know, also it also helps them mentally, psychologically, and it also, you know, help build the confidence and the discipline, and certainly make sure that they have the esteem that they need to continue on.
Yeah, it's great. Great concept, because when I was actually doing substitute teaching, I got involved in an alternative school, and they kind of permanently based me there for the rest of the year. And it was just kids that had gotten in a little trouble here and there, you know, suburban community, Massachusetts. And, you know, a couple of them just needed basically somebody to give them some extra attention, to deal with their quirks, and to, you know, teach them one-on-one. And I helped a couple of kids graduate. So it was a good feeling to be involved. And, you know, somebody that couldn't learn in the traditional environment, not only couldn't learn, but was disrupting because he couldn't learn. And, you know, it's just a couple little things that you have to watch out for with some of these kids. Some of them might have a disorder. Some of them just might have a tough upbringing they're dealing with at home.
Sure.
There was one who had already had a teen mother pregnant that was there. So I had a long talk with him one day, and he totally changed his mind about everything and ended up moving to Florida the next day. It's like, whoa.
Wow.
I guess I got a question on him. He wanted to be with the baby's mother, you know, and be there for the kid. So it's like, wow. But, yeah, it's definitely makes a big difference to those kids when somebody gives them the attention that they need and they start to realize, hey, I can do this. I can learn. And, you know, just thinking about what happens to that kid without that person that helps them, you know. Do they still go down that path? Or they become worse.
Well,
you know,
see, that's why after school's program come into play, you know, because what we do is we try to follow behind, you know, what they're learning in school or how we can enhance that or how we can help assist with what they're already learning. And, you know, we have 12 years of successfully operating since 2003. You know, so apparently, you know it works, you know, and, our goal is to try to get as many programs out here as possible in every part of the city because, you know, I live in such a big city. And not only that, you know, we're looking to also expand, you know, on the outside of Philadelphia as well into some of the suburban areas. I mean, you have to look. There's kids everywhere. This program was put together for children. And, you know, anywhere that there's a location that's looking to host an after-school program such as Fight to Learn, you know, we would love to come to the table and see what the possibilities are because you have these parents in these communities who want their children to be in a safe and structured environment after school where they don't be in the streets getting themselves into trouble because the most troublesome times for children is between the hours of 3 and 6. That's when they get out of school, and most parents don't see their children until 6 o'clock. It's a troublesome time for them. Therefore, they had all this idle time to gear their attention to something negative, but parents in the community want their children to be in an environment where they, number one, safe off the streets. That's number one. I mean, I don't care how good a program is academically. If the children are not safe, the program, as far as I'm concerned, means nothing. Safety is first. Everything else follows behind that. And the parents love to have their children in a place where they can come pick them up as soon as they get off work. And knowing that their children have a full schedule after-school program, you know, we're not a babysitting facility. We are a full-blown after-school program that offer all types of excellent components. And, you know, we offer recreation activities as well because the kids have to be able to socialize as well. I mean, hey, kids are in school all day long. They don't want to come and tune out that school program that's completely, you know, educational as well. So you got to find time and make a balance to make sure that you offer also some type of recreational and social time for them as well because social time a lot of times is just as important as academic time for children, especially ages 5, 6, and 7, around that age. So we offer just such great components for them that will help enhance them. Our components consist of homework tutors. We got the tutors there to help the kids with the homework. make sure the homework is done, make sure that it's checked, which helps the parents a whole lot when they come home. A lot of times parents are tired. You know, a lot of times, you know, they may not be able to help the children with the homework. So with the after-school program, we make sure that we have the tutors there to help these kids complete their homework. We have computer training. I mean, hey, this is the 21st century. Kids need to learn how to not just go on the computer and play games, how to do research, how to complete their homework, how to do those type of things, how to send and retrieve emails, you know, how to go on a computer and do things that's academically to create a resume. So they need to do those kind of things, and how to work in Word and how to work in WordPerfect, you know, and how to work and do spreadsheets. How do they develop a resume? We offer cultural enrichments. We have health and fitness component. And we also offer athletic activities, because kids need also to do something that can get them in some type of physical activity, you know, get them off the couch, you know, where they can get into something where they can develop discipline, you know, which I think is one of the number one things that come from athletics.
Yeah, you know, the teamwork part of it helps too, you know. Helps a lot. Keeps the mind sharp too. A lot of people don't realize that. You know, you get the blood pumping, keeps the mind sharp, right?
Sure. I mean, kids need some kind of physical activity. That's why gym is a major in school now. Remember when it used to not be? It has to be now, because how many kids are going to get exercises?
And how do people support this? How do they help the charity out and donate their time or their money to this?
Sure. Well, you know, as a nonprofit, all nonprofit, you know, certainly welcomes, you know, donations and contributions and all that type of thing. You know, that's how nonprofits continues to exist. You know, Fight to Learn, you know, we're always open to accept, you know, tax-deductible donations and contributions, because we are not just a nonprofit, but we are a 501c3, which is a tax-exempt organization. So, you know, people can visit our website at www.fighttolearn, fighttolearn.com, and they can take a look at one of our links called How to Donate. And at this moment, we are offering a wonderful sponsorship opportunity to companies, businesses, and individuals. And for further information, they can go and they can take a look at our website as well, or they can contact our office for those who are interested. And our office number is 215-514-8748. They can get more information on how they can become a sponsor to help us continue to help the at-risk children of the program and the communities that we currently serve. And, you know, I would like to certainly give a thank you to all of our funders and sponsors. However, we like to give a special thank you to our champion sponsor, which is the Law Offices of Offutt Kerman. And, you know, currently we have two locations, plus we have a long-time partnership with the Oakland Presbyterian Church since 2010. So we're certainly on our way to build. We're on our way to try to expand the program. It's just that we want to get the information out there for people who have buildings or know of someone who have locations that are interested in hosting, you know, such a long, 12-year successful after-school program. We would love to bring our programs to the communities to help the children, you know, in your communities.
Right. Cool. Well, I'll definitely support what you're doing. Appreciate it. And I'm sure the people that you work with appreciate it even more. And I'm sure it's got to give you that good feeling too, to be involved in anything like that where you're helping people out. And it's your job. I mean, it's like, people don't realize, I think, sometimes when you do charity work, how it comes back to you.
It's a good feeling, you know, because you know you're doing something, you know, especially to help, you know, our children. You know, I mean, I think we're all responsible for children, whether, you know, no matter what color they are, you know, no matter if they're not our children, you know, that we had, you know, personally. But realistically, you know, it's our job to pave the way for them, just like it was the generations before us' job to pave the way for us. You know, we were all put here to help somebody. You know, it's not about you. It's not about me. It's about who can you help. You know, you can't help everybody, but you can help somebody. We're all responsible to help somebody because, see, somebody helped you. Somebody helped me. That's why we're where we are today, because of somebody giving us an opportunity. Well, we need to give them an opportunity as well to move forward, you know, to help put them in position one day where they can give back and become, you know, citizens, you know, where they would be productive, as they can become productive citizens in our society and workplace.
Very cool stuff. And obviously, we've got to talk about your boxing career. You had a pretty impressive run in the ring there as a pro. You also do some amateur boxing, too?
I did do amateur boxing before I turned professional. I had 43 amateur bouts. Before I turned professional, I had a record of 41-2, and I won all sorts of amateur tournaments like the Sugar Ray Leonard tournament. I won the Golden Glove tournament. I won something that was called the ABF tournament. I won those tournaments as an amateur, so I did have an impressive amateur career as well. It's hard to find amateur careers listed because no one really lists those, but you will find a professional career on a fighter. But, you know, a lot of that stems, and it starts from the amateurs, really, and you well know, a lot of times guys just don't appear out of nowhere. You know, somewhere along the line, they were already fighting prior until they really, you know, came on the scene.
Right. Yeah, Tony and I have a little amateur records of our own from college boxing.
Wow.
We were supposed to fight, but it never quite materialized. Right, Tony?
We almost got signed up to fight twice. You were one of the opponents that was listed for my senior year home show, and then we almost met in the Nationals. Rodney, I'm a fellow Philadelphian. I've met you. Dan, actually, I met you. I have a picture of us together.
Are you
at
serious?
The old Philadelphia Spectrum back in 2002, I think it was. They
wow.
had a fight card there. One of my – in fact, we sat next to each other. One
Are
of
you
the
serious?
Guys that I used to train with fought in the main event that night.
You wait a minute. You used to train with whoever fought in the main event that night?
Yeah, his name – remember, I'm going back to 2002 here. But
okay.
His name was Mambia Bakari. We trained together at the Marian Anderson Recreation Center.
Okay.
And
okay.
Another guy that was one of – he came over from Tanzania. And one of the young guys that came with him fought for a world title three times by the name of Rogers Mataagwa.
Oh, sure.
So I used to train with both of them.
Sure.
Yeah, we used to train down at Marian Anderson together back in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
And at that card at the Spectrum, you and I just happened to sit next to each other.
Okay, I remember Mataagwa. He was a small guy, right?
Yeah,
he was a
featherweight.
Featherweight, yeah, he was a small guy.
He,
as a matter of fact, I think I seen him fight for one of the crowns on TV. I'm not sure who he fought the last time I seen him fight. It was for a title, but I'm going back to maybe 2009, 2010, somewhere around there.
Yeah, the first time he fought Juan Manuel Lopez.
Right,
and
okay.
He had Lopez out on his feet in the 12th round.
Sure.
And the bell rang and basically saved Lopez because Lopez was out.
Sure, you got it right.
Lopez got the decision. Then he fought on HBO and he got stopped by Uriokas Gamboa.
Sure.
And then he fought Johnny Gonzalez and he got stopped.
Okay, I saw the Gamboa fight. That's the fight I remember seeing.
Yeah, he got knocked down a couple times. I mean, hey, no shame in losing a guy like Gamboa.
Oh, absolutely. No, he fought some great champions and Johnny Gonzalez is still a great champion. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So he certainly fought some monster champions. And when you get in there with those kind of guys, you know, you really have nothing to lose anyway, you know, but you can step in there and give it your all. You know, fighting is a tough sport, as you guys well know. It's a risky sport. You know, it's a lot of people say they want to fight. A lot of people, you know, wish they had became a fighter. And a lot of guys have an opportunity to become a fighter. But once you go in the gym, I've seen it so many times through so many years – And I realized that out of 100% guys coming to the gym, you might have a 10%, you might have 10% of guys that actually stays in the gym that actually makes a complete long career out of fighting. So that lets you know that boxing is not what a lot of people think it is. You just have to have it in you. And it takes so much more than just heart and guts. It takes so much more than that to actually make a full-blown career out of it. And not just that, make it to certain levels in your career, because you're not guaranteed to keep taking the steps, the next levels up. You know what I mean? You and I both know something could happen in your career mentally, psychologically, where you were picked to be such a great fighter. That's on paper. It has to happen in the ring. You've seen it many a times. I can name guys left and right. Oh, he's going to be champ. He's going to be champion. And there's always that guy that no one never looked at, all of a sudden shines like a star. You know what I mean? And I've seen it to me because I was one of those guys. So I understand that, that significance of being around a lot of fighters that people thought was going to be such a great fighter never turned out to be that way. Then you got a guy who was so disciplined, who sat in the back and waited for his turn. And all of a sudden, it came out and, like, wow. So it was him all the time. See what I mean? I'm sure you guys seen it as well.
The one guy they always talk about, especially with that, was a fighter who was 17-17. And he was brought in to fight Roger Mayweather, and they were expecting him to get knocked out. Well, there was a knockout, and it was Mayweather knocked out, and that was Freddie Pendleton.
Oh, the one of the most dangerous, one of the most Freddie Pendleton was so, how do you say, unpredictable, okay, that you never knew what would happen with Fred. But one thing you knew, he could punch, okay? You knew, he could punch. And sure, a record in boxing certainly means nothing to promoters. It means nothing to fight fans. What happens is, when you step in the ring with a guy, you could be 20-0. Well, when you guys step in the ring, you never fought each other, you actually 0-0, you know, because we never fought each other, you know what I mean? So I'm not on your record, you're not on my record. So we're actually 0-0 when we step in the ring because we never fought each other. So to me, you 0-0 against me, and I'm 0-0 against you, you know what I mean? So, you know, a record means nothing in boxing, because a record, if you look on paper and the record wins fights, then the fight should never happen. Just give them the win, you know what I mean?
Right.
For the person who has a different, who has a better record. But you and I both know upsets happens every day, just like champions win and lose the titles every day. Records mean nothing until two guys step into the ring and see what happens. Because if you pay attention to a record, that's the guy that can always surprise you at any moment because he has nothing to lose. And a record, if you look at a record, for some of them guys like Freddie Pendleton, you would think he can't fight, okay?
Exactly.
He's the kind of guy that put knock your lights out.
And I know, like, some of the guys that I used to train with. I mean, I trained with guys like Marion Anderson. They got a lot of bad breaks in their career. You know, they were coming in last minute guys. They were fighting out of town guys. They weren't getting decisions. So I'm looking at a guy, and I'm like, I trained with this guy. How is he like 4-12 or something along those lines? And he's better than that. And then he took this fight on 24 hours notice in, like, West Virginia. He took this one. This guy was a highly touted Olympian. He was an Olympic bronze medalist. And our guy took the fight and basically real training. And they were both 0-0, but this guy had a better amateur career. This guy was more pedigree. So, they were both other professionals, but this guy basically, in experience-wise, was much more experienced, you know, so it was a bad match. And I used to know one manager that he wanted to sign me to a contract, and I wouldn't sign, because he would throw anybody in there with anybody, and he was getting his guys beat. And then his guys were, by the time they were really trying to make a move, they were seen, you know, as trail horses.
Sure. And see, you know, and speaking of Fred, just going back to Fred, Fred was one of those kind of guys, just like we speaking of, that would take fights, you know, at the spare of the moment, because Freddie wasn't afraid to fight anybody. And he got a lot of bad decisions. You know what I mean? He actually certainly had a lot of bad decisions. So he was certainly much better than his record indicated, just like, you know, Livingston Bramble was. Huh?
Yeah. He's agreeing with you.
Yeah.
You know, just like Livingston Bramble was, a whole lot better than his record indicated. They said Bramble got 25 losses. But see, once again, that was after Bramble's career was pretty much over. See what I mean? A lot of those losses came then. But at his time, he was a monster.
Well, another Philadelphia legend who recently passed away a few years ago. If you look at his record now, you see a lot of losses on there. But they were all at the end of his career, and that was Matthew Saab Mahanis.
Exactly. It was at the end of his career. Once again, Benny Briscoe, you know what I mean? Once again, you look at animals like that, who a lot of times it happened more like the end of his career, but the record doesn't make the fighter. The record doesn't make the fight at all. You guys well know it. When you step in the ring with a guy, you just have to look at a guy being 0-0, because like I said, if you start looking at a record and paying attention to somebody's record, you know, that's a bad way to judge a fighter. You know, you can't size a fight up like that. You got to go in there and fight this guy like as though he was 100-0, you know what I mean? I mean, you got to train against him like you would train against anybody. They say, you know, you can't get yourself up against a less of a fighter. Well, you know what? That's mental. You know what I mean? That's psychological. And it happens to all of us. It happened to me, and it happened to a lot of fighters out there. But you have to get yourself up from everybody, because both guys stepping in the ring with two hands. Nobody has one hand, and the other person got three hands. We come in there on an even playing field. You got two hands and two legs. I got two hands and two legs. So you have to try to be at the best of your game anytime you step in the ring with any man with 8-ounce gloves on, because he's trying to win just like you're trying to win.
I got a funny story from my amateur career. I boxed, I trained at Marian Anderson Rec Center, but I boxed when I was in college. I boxed for Lock Haven University up in central Pennsylvania. And I was a sophomore. Now, my freshman year, I only had about four fights, and I was 1-3. My first fight in the novice class, I got stopped. I got stopped because I was fighting a kid. Now, I was 18. He was around 22. He was more experienced than I was. He had a year under his belt. And it was a fight that happened at the last minute because another kid didn't make weight. And I wasn't in shape. And this kid beat me. You know, he stopped me in the third round. And then I came back to Philadelphia, and I really started training. I really started dedicating myself. I started running again. I got myself in shape. And I won my next fight. I stopped the kid in the second round. And then they bumped me up to open class. And I fought two guys that ended up fighting for the regional title that year. Okay. And I lost decisions to both of them. Pretty close decisions. So I was 1-3. Okay. I came back at home that summer, and I spent every night down at Marian Anderson sparring with guys that were going pro.
Okay.
Training with guys, learning the craft of boxing. Now, I come back for my sophomore year, and we're going to have our first show of the year. And I had actually gone to the coach's office to drop something off, and he was on the phone with a coach from the, I think it was it the University of Buffalo, maybe? It was somewhere up in New York. And they were supposed to bring some kids onto the show. And he had a fighter that was around 175 pounds. I was around 180. We had another kid on our team that was around 172. So either one of us could have fought him. But the guy was asking questions. The other coach was like, "Oh, well, you're 172 pounder. What's his record?" Well, he was 4-1, but he had fought all sub novice fighters. You know, he had fought guys that were, you know, very inexperienced.
Sure.
And he won four of those fights. Then he goes, "Well, your other guy, your 180 pounder. What's his record?" Well, he's 1-3. Oh, 1-3, huh? Well, are either of them, punchers? Now, I am a puncher. I'm a short, stocky guy, learning from that Marciano kind of Frazier, grindy down, roughy up kind of style. And the coach looks at me and he winks. He goes, "No." He goes, "Oh, one guy, he's only had one stoppage, and he was against a novice fighter." And the guy was like, "Okay, we'll take the guy that's 1-3. And I saw my coach smile ear to ear, and he winked at me, and he hung up the phone and goes, "Okay, fight set." And he goes, "We pulled the wool over their eyes." And he goes, "He thinks he's getting the fighter that's the lesser of the two." He goes, "He doesn't know he's getting the open class kid, not the novice class kid." And I was so excited for that fight, you know. And unfortunately, Buffalo gets hit with a blizzard. They don't make the show. I ended up fighting somebody else. But, but you're talking about the record. This guy was going on record only.
Yeah,
not going on who each guy has fought.
Right. You got to look at the whole resume. You have to look and see who you know, the losses against, you know, who they fought, you know, what kind of fight they were in. You know, you have to it's just more than the record because, like I said, that'll do it to you every time when you believe in you fighting a guy that's 5-15 opposed to fighting a guy that's 15-5. I mean, let's think about it. What do you got to win against a guy that's 5-15? You got everything to lose anyway. You see what I mean? So you got to be careful when you fight them kind of guys. When it's time to step up in class, you have to step up in class, and you have to fight somebody of a, you know, a higher level, a little bit much better level than you. That's the only way you can start testing yourself. You know, you have to test yourself against people that is more experienced than you, and you would never know, you know, what kind of fighter you are mentally and physically and psychologically until you get in there with somebody that's going to be sharper than you, you know, that you can't make, you got to make very few mistakes on because they can counter when you do things wrong. You got to be able to get in there with those kind of guys, take, you know, so to say, better punches and see what kind of heart you really got. That's, you know, the difference of stepping up in weight, stepping up in class and keeping yourself at a level where you should have been, you know, far along. You still fighting, you know, those class of guys, and you into your 10th fight. I mean, really? You still fighting guys that's up below you, and you then already had 10 fights, you know? You and I both know you move fighters along, but you don't hold them back. It comes a time where you have to test your fighter to see what he really has. It comes that time.
Yeah, definitely. What would you say was your toughest fight of your career, Rodney?
Well, I mean, out of the 50 fights I had, professional fights, there's no questions about it. My toughest fight I had was against the undefeated, you know, knockout Puerto Rican greats. The best Puerto Rican fighter they got rated as all time was Felix Tito Trinidad. I mean, you know, it was an honor to, you know, be on a couple of Trinidad's undercards. So, I mean, I knew eventually I was going to get the shot at him. Although I was fighting at junior welterweight, he was always at welterweight. I knew eventually I was going to move up in weight, you know, to be able to get the opportunity to fight Trinidad. And I thought he was such a great fighter. I thought he was a monster of a champion. But I always believed, and like I said, testing yourself sometime to see what you really have. So, I mean, I stepped in the ring with a much bigger guy, with a much with the best puncher in the division at that time of being champion. He, you know, one of the most experienced and crafty guys out there. I mean, everybody knows Trinidad was such a beast. So I wanted to give myself an opportunity to step in the ring with a guy like him to see, you know, how can I, you know, challenge and push myself against a guy like that. He hits extremely hard. He's a power puncher, difficult guy to hit, and he was such a great champion. They did not rank him as Puerto Rico's best fight of all time. I mean, this is what, you know, the people in Puerto Rico voted him as. I don't know if you guys have seen that a few years ago.
Right.
But out of all the great fighters that come out of Puerto Rico, and that's saying something big, they rate Tito Trinidad as the number one fighter in Puerto Rico of all time. And that's saying something even bigger, to be able to have an opportunity to step in the ring with such a great champion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, and he was a big welterweight because, I mean, you figure, what was it, only within a 2 or 3 years after that fight, he was moving up and he's fighting full-fledged middleweight.
Middleweight's right. So, I mean, he was right. I mean, he made me look very extra small because I was, like I said, I was a junior welterweight anyway. But I got to a point where I fought at junior welterweight too long. My body was getting too big for the division, but I was still not actually a full-fledged welterweight. There is no in-between weights, as you guys well know. You're either 40 or you're 47, you know what I mean, when it comes down to fighting championship fights. So that means I had to step up in a weight class that was much, you know, bigger than, and people don't understand. There's a difference between when it comes down to 5 and 6 and 7 pounds. I know to the average person they don't understand. They say, it's just 4 pounds. Well, it makes all the difference in the world, as you guys well know. The pounds of pressure is totally different when you're in there with a bigger guy a much bigger guy, and you're only saying 7 pounds, it's not only 7 pounds in a boxing game, as you well know. It makes all the difference in the world. So Al, I'm getting in there with a 147-pounder who hits just like a middleweight, and I fought some welterweights prior to that just to see, you know, how I can take those punches and how I can handle myself with a much bigger guy, you know, even with pushing and shoving, you know, and even just the punches, period. But, I, you know, they tested me with some few welterweights, and I beat them all before I got the shot at Felix Trinidad. But, you know, stepping into the ring with him, it was just a whole different atmosphere. You know, it was just totally different. The arena is bigger. You know, the class is totally different. And I'm in there with the best welterweight on the planet at that time.
Right. Yeah, that must have been a trip. You know, obviously because you've watched him, you know he's such a great fighter. And then to be in there across from him, knowing you got to try to beat him.
Then I got to go, right, sure. I mean, I got myself up for the fight. I came in the ring, and I came to fight. I came to try to win like I always do. There's another time I stepped in the ring not to try to win. I was in some battles. I mean, the 50 pro fights I had, I mean, I had 95 fights throughout my whole career, amateur plus professional, you know, somewhere around there. But when I stepped in the ring, I always was in shape. So I came to fight. And anybody that was in the ring with me knew that, you know, this guy didn't hit a fight. You know, I was a great body puncher, which gave me the opportunity to get as far as I had gotten because my left hook to the body was such a superb punch, which the late Milt Bailey, which was one of my trainers, used to say, hey, that's going to take you to a world title shot. You remind me of Alexis Arguello. He used to always say that, like, you know, you're such a good stand-up boxer puncher who reads fighters well, who can use the jab, but you can also throw body punches with your height, which I used to throw body shots, you know, from all angles, but the left hook to the body was my signature punch, and you best believe it allowed me to stop a lot of fighters because, you know, hitting a fighter to the head all the time is not what it's about. You and I both know sometimes fighters got such good chins, they can shake it off, but when you constantly hit that body and hit that body and hit them with perfect pinpoint accurate body shots, get up under the rib cages, get around the rib cages, you and I both know that takes a different toll on the fighter throughout the fight. I didn't work the body for one round. I threw body shots throughout the whole fight, as long as it lasts, because you best believe that was a way that I knew that would have me weaken you through the fight. I wasn't a one-punch knockout guy. I was a cumulative type of puncher that eventually I would wear you down because of the pinpoint accurate body shots that I would land, and I would land them throughout the night enough to where you're ready to quit or you don't have energy or you just say, you know, I can't take it no more. So, you know, the 20 stoppages, knockouts that I got throughout my professional career, I was able to do that on accumulating the punches. And believe me, the body shots was what helped set it up, you know, throughout, you know, the fight, which gave me the chance to stop, you know, more than half of the wins that I have by knockout.
You know what, I always joke around, I would refer to that type of style because that was similar to the way I would fight too, you know, a lot of body shots, a lot of pressure. I wasn't a one-punch knockout guy. I threw a lot of left hooks. That was my best punch. Loved the left hook to the body.
Okay.
I used to always refer to that type of style, and I used to call it creeping death.
Okay.
Especially because I was a shorter guy. I fought a lot of taller fighters.
Sure.
So I'm neutralizing their jab. I'm putting pressure on them, and I'm making them work because I'm always advancing. So you either got to move or you got to punch. But no matter what, you got to do something.
Okay.
So at the same time, even if I'm trying to conserve energy, I'm still putting enough pressure on where you're working, even if I'm not, and hit that body, hit that body, hit that body. And eventually that breaks you physically, but it also breaks you mentally because no matter where you go, it's like I'm a bubble constrictor. I don't let you breathe, and I get a little bit tighter and a little bit tighter and a little bit tighter to the fact of, you know, your body's crushed. I used to always say when I lived where I would chop, you know, I would always get big chunks of oak wood, and I would chop them, the real thick ones. And the one joke I always said, there was a picture of me doing it. And I said, chopping wood is like hitting the body. Sometimes you hit them first few knocks, and that wood is solid. You bounce off it. But you keep doing it, and you finally hear a little bit of a crack.
Exactly.
You hear it crack a little bit, and that wood, you can feel it weakening. Just like an opponent. And then finally, it wilts. It wilts under the body attack. That was my mentality.
What devastating shots to land. I mean, you know, for those out there who's, who don't understand the craft and the skill of boxing, you know, a jab is the number one weapon, you know, that you can use, you know, which is supposed to be the fundamentals of boxing. Now, everybody can learn to use a jab, whether you're short, whether you're small. A jab can offset anybody if it's used properly, as you well know. And that because you're short and that because you don't have no long arms, a jab still can neutralize anybody if it's effective for that particular opponent that you're fighting. But a jab is like a pawn on the, pawn on the chessboard. The most important weapon that you can have is a jab. A jab can also just be a range finder, you know what I mean? A jab could just be enough where if I could touch him with the jab, then I could touch him with any other punch. So a jab is used sometimes to just throw and offset, you know, your opponent, even if you're not aiming to land it, you know what I mean? It at least try to blind you, and it don't let you know whatever punch is coming. So the jab is the most important weapon that any fighter can develop, whether you meaning to land it or not. You got to just be able to use it, but you got to bring that hand back. You can't leave it out there lazy because you really certainly open yourself up for a counter, especially for a right hand if you're fighting an orthodox fighter or a right hook if you're fighting a, you know, a southpaw and you're orthodox. So you got to be careful using the jab. You got to use it properly and bring the hand back properly, but it's the most important weapon that you could use because that punch will bust you up and that punch hurts if it snaps and they keep on hitting you. It's like getting hit with a missile. And it's, you've seen a lot of guys knock guys out with jabs and even knock you down with a jab. That shows you how difficult and how hard a jab is, especially if you're snapping it. It's a very difficult weapon, as you guys well know that. And people that don't understand the game don't understand that that jab is just that important. So when they see it, they say, ah, the jab don't look like nothing. I said, yeah, well, come here a second. I used to put them in front of me, snap the jab, and stop it in front of their face. They was like, wow, if I get hit with that. I said, that's what a jab is like.
Exactly.
It'll give you.
You know what, Rodney? It was one of the funny things is when I first got at Marion Anderson, and I already had an amateur fight before I even started at Marion Anderson. And I remember my trainer, his name was Kevin Burwell, and he pulled me aside one day and he watched the film of my fight, the first one where I lost.
Okay.
He goes, two things, son. He goes, we got to get you in shape. And two, he goes, you're throwing bombs out there. You're throwing your big left hooks and you're throwing your big right hands. But he goes, the problem is, you're a short guy, and you're walking straight in, and these guys are tattooing you with their reach. He goes, what you got to learn how to do is neutralize a taller man's jab. And that's what he taught me. He taught me how to catch a jab and then time it, just like Eddie Futch had Kenny Norton do to Muhammad Ali.
Sure.
Time it and jab with the guy.
Exactly.
Goes, think of this philosophy. If you got a tall guy who's got a good jab, and he throws that jab, and you stop it, and you catch it with your open hand, and you time it, and you stick your jab right in his mouth. You do that two or three times, and guess what? He stops jabbing. Now, his best weapon is now neutralized, and he's got to fight you on your terms. He's
exactly. got to
fight the short man in close because his jab's gone. And they taught me, for a short guy, I didn't have a quick, snappy Ali-type jab, but I had a hard Liston-type jab.
Got you.
And my jab is meant to hurt you. And I'd jab you in the chest. I'd jab you in the shoulders.
Sure.
And wherever that glove went, it was meant to hurt.
Got you. It's a very, it's a tool, like you said, you can use it for so many different type of ways. It's just an important weapon to learn. To be a fighter, you have to learn how to jab, no matter how you look at it. A jab is used for anyone, and everybody that's a boxer should learn how to use a jab, no matter if you're a slugger or not. Sluggers need to use the jab, too.
Yep.
Sometimes you got to jab your way inside, you know what I mean? Sometimes you got to jab your way to get inside.
It's funny you mentioned the jab, because that is my favorite punch. I've said it again and again on this show, so I can confirm it. But, I used to love it because I was a defensive fighter, period. You know, I didn't like to even take the risk of getting hit by being too aggressive. So I used the quick jab a lot. And I used the quick jab so much that I would go around to parties and stuff and let people box me with two gloves, and I would just use the one. Just jab. So
just
that's
so
how
you jab.
Yeah. And I love the fact that, you know, you didn't have to throw a hard punch to really piss somebody off and get them off their game. The very, not the very last time I sparred at all, but the time before that, they threw me after probably 8 years not touching anybody in the ring at all. They put me in sparring match with a kid after I've been training a little while, trying to get into the pros for the first time. Didn't work out, but that's another story with the body shots. The kid I fought next actually broke my rib with a body shot, so that ended my back. But anyway, this fight, 30 seconds in, with this quick jab, I bloodied his nose. So it was, like, so easy from that point on, knowing that I had that power to do that. And then, you know, he had that sense of, oh, geez, I'm bleeding already. So it was, like, over in his mind. It was a great sparring session because I learned that lesson. But actually, the biggest lesson I learned about the jab was national tournament. 1998 was the only national tournament I was able to go to because I went to Virginia Military Institute for a semester, and they had a professional, well, not professional, but college boxing team that went to all the different colleges around. And our main competition was the Naval Academy. And this kid from the Naval Academy kicked the crap out of me the first scrimmage. I was way out of shape. So I get through the 6 months of their boxing training down there at Virginia Military Institute. It was run by an old colonel named Gordy Calkins, and an old Marine Corps colonel. And he was a tough guy himself. So we end up getting all the way to nationals, and I end up getting this kid in the regionals that kicked my ass at the scrimmage. And sure enough, the jab got me out of that jam, too, because he had a big grin on his face when he saw I was fighting him. And he went all to the body, just like he did the first time to put me out. I got to quit the first time at the scrimmage. Never quit in a fight. Ever again before that or ever after that. So I basically, he thought all he could do was go to the body and I'd be all done. But I just sat there and I jabbed him from a distance and I threw hooks at his head the whole time.
You know, I think of... And, you know, a jab is so important, but in Philadelphia, you know, that I'm not saying no other state, you know, another city, because I'm not from no other city, but I know in Philadelphia, you know, you are pretty much taught the jab right away. In any gyms, I think, in Philadelphia, you are taught the jab no matter what. I mean, I think of my early professional career when I fought, you know, a lot of guys. You usually fight a lot of guys from your town when you're coming along, and you had to fight, you know, a guy that everybody knew. Now you got to fight somebody from your city, which usually is for bragging rights. And you never want to lose to a guy from the same city because everybody know you both. You know what I mean? And you might run into each other. That's the last guy you want to lose to. So I think of all the Philadelphia fighters I fought throughout my career, luckily for me, I have never lost to a fellow Philadelphian, which was amazing because, you know, Philadelphia is known, as you well know, for having such great fighters. And no, they said the gym wars, you know, when you fight a guy from your town, that's pretty much like a gym war because everybody got, you got so much to lose because of being a neighborhood thing, and you really got to keep your head on. And a lot of times the styles go out the window. What you train for becomes different because when you step in the ring with him, now you got so much more to prove, you end up fighting a whole different type of fight, you know, because you're trying to prove yourself. Now you in the crowd, everybody know you, everybody know him, you're in there with family and friends and the neighborhood, and that's the last guy you're going to lose to. So luckily for me, throughout my professional career, I have never lost to a Philadelphia fighter. And, you know, my biggest accomplishment, and people don't realize this, my biggest accomplishment is, number one, being listed on a prominent boxing poster in Philly for being rated as an all-time great. Since 1901 to the date, I am one of those fighters that's listed on Philadelphia's all-time great. Not only that, they also listed me in Philadelphia. I mean, you're talking hundreds of thousands of fighters since 1901. You know, I am ranked in Philadelphia as the number fifth ranked junior welterweight of all time. Now you're talking about decades, 100 years of decades of fighters that I must have became one of the best in my decade, in my era, because to be ranked number five, and we're talking about over 100 years. To me, those accomplishments are just truly amazing because you and I both know we got nothing but killer fighters that come out of the city of Philadelphia. And, you know, people say, well, you went into the Hall of Fame twice. You went into Jersey. You went into Pennsylvania. I said, yeah, they were great. But to be ranked the fifth-ranked junior welterweight of all time and to be put on that poster, listed on there as one of the greatest of all time, they were just as big an accomplishment to me as you know, being voted to the Hall of Fame, which is accomplishments that's written in stone. So, sure, I am a two-time Boxing Hall of Fame inductee, I never thought that in my career that would happen, but I had such an amazing career. And fortunate for me, I still have some faculties left where I can speak, where I can talk, where I can hold conversations with people, and I still have some articulacy with me. And I don't know what's going to happen 5 years from now, but for right now, I still got, you know, I still can talk, you know, and speak very well. So I have to at least, you know, take it day by day, because you and I both know a lot of times, you know, those shots come down on us 10 and 15, 20 years after being retired. So luckily for me, I've got 15 years to be retired. It hasn't came down yet. But, you know, there's still the future to go. We don't know what's going to happen. Because once we take a lot of those shots, you and I both know, they stay with you. They don't go away.
Some people take more genetics with that. You know, there were studies done that showed that some people just literally have thicker skulls.
Sure. Sure. And it's, of course, the how you absorb the punch, you know, how many punches you've taken. You and I both know it comes down to a lot of things other than that. Because you may take a better punch than somebody. Somebody may take a better punch than you. But does that mean, you know, down the line, you're going to be in better health than that person after the boxing game is over? No. We don't know what's going to happen when it's over. Until you, how many guys have you seen 5 years prior, when they were fighting, you seen them 5 years later, they were totally different people? Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
You say, wow, he wasn't like that 5 years. And to me, that's the sad part of boxing. You know, a guy put his blood, sweat, and tears in the game. He give you all he got. And then, you know, unfortunately, two fists can ruin your life. It actually can ruin your life. I mean, it made a lot of guys not be the same because of all of the punishment that we sustain inside the ring. We take some brutal punches. We take some, you know, it takes a lot, you know, and I both know, to be a fighter. And to me, the champion is not the guy who won all the titles and made all the money. And after his career, he, as we say, punchy, the champion is the guy that might have not been so good of a fighter, but today he's living like a normal person. So who's the champion?
And you still got the bragging right.
Well, Rodney, a perfect example was a couple years ago, literally we had three fighters almost back-to-back-to-back from the 1988 Olympic team. All were professional world champions. Mm-hmm. We had Ray Mercer, great right. interview. You know, we joked around a lot with Ray. We talked about his career. We had Roy Jones. Now, Roy,
okay.
for as great a career as he's had, now, over the last 2 years, he's been knocked out a couple times
sure.
pretty violently.
Sure.
Carver knocked him out. Glenn Johnson
sure.
knocked him out cold. Got knocked out over in Russia. I forget by the boy's name, but he got knocked. I mean, these were some, you know, pretty scary knockouts.
Sure.
Roy is sharp as a tack. I mean, he
exactly.
still does HBO commentating.
Oh, he's great.
Sharp as a tack. Great interview. He was remembering everything. We joked around with him. Then we had Riddick Bell on the phone with us. And Riddick, if you remember that second fight with Andrew Gallada,
sure.
was slurring pretty bad after that fight
sure.
was over. Now, Riddick actually only lost officially one fight in his career. That was the rematch to Holyfield, the Fan Man fight.
Okay.
But he took, you know, some beatings and some other fights.
He
had only lost once. With Riddick, we basically, and I hate to say this because it's not funny, but when he laughed, we would laugh just because he was doing the punchline to a joke. But we couldn't understand what he was saying, unfortunately.
Okay.
He was slurring that bad on the phone with us. And we just knew he said something funny because he was laughing. So we
sure.
just laughed with him.
Just laugh with it. You know, and that's the sad part of boxing, you know, to see, you know, such like I said, ex-great champions that today, you know, is really slurring really bad. You know, and, it's sad to see that, you know, because, you know, you don't want to see a fighter physically damaged after, you know, the career is over. You know, you want them to still be able to live normally. And fortunately for me, I was one of those fighters, and I see a whole lot more. And like you said, Roy Jones, he is such a great commentator. He found his niche, you know, and I look at so many other fighters that were great inside the ring. Now you need to be able to function normally after the ring. That, to me, is the real fight.
Chad, Roy won't quit fighting, right?
Still fighting.
Keeps taking. All right, Roddy, we got to wrap it up here. We're coming to the end of the show.
One last thing I do have to say, Ronnie, it was as great as this interview as it is, there's one question I got to leave it with. what does it feel like to still be known as the king of the Blue Horizon?
Yeah, I wanted to ask that too.
Well, I got to say this. So many great world champions have fought at the Blue Horizon. I mean, you can name them continuously. To be able to have that title pinned to you from USA commentators Sean O'Grady and Al Albert for all of the great fights that come across the world to fight the Blue, because the Blue Rise was always rated as the number one boxing venue. To be named, they named me Mr. Blue Horizon at first. Then eventually they upgraded me to the king of the Blue Horizon. Now, you know, you couldn't say Blue Horizon without saying Rodney Moore. You know, I was one of the USA Tuesday Night Fights, you know, top five fighters. I had the most fights on USA Tuesday Night Fights, and right behind me was George Foreman, and I'm not sure if it was Carbajal. I think it was Michael Carbajal. They were behind me with another fight or two less than me. But, you know, every time USA came in, you know, people, they seen me on USA fighting at the Blue Horizon. So many fighters across the nation wanted to come to Philadelphia just to be and just to see what the Blue Horizon was like. And I've seen a lot of fighters come out of town just to be a part of Blue Horizon. But to answer your question, that title is going to be with me for the rest of my life because I inherited that title by professional boxing commentators, and the fans, you know, thought that I should have been named that title because not just having the most fights there, every fight I had was entertaining. I was never in a boring fight. One way or the other, I gave fight fans what they wanted, and that was a fight. No matter how you looked at it. When I stepped in the ring, I came to fight. It didn't matter. A lot of times I did brawling, which I shouldn't have had, but I did because that's what I wanted to do. You know, I could have boxed more. I could have used my jab more. But sometimes when you get in the fight, man, you start fighting ways that you may not want to fight. But at that time, yep. You think it's best for you. You know what I mean? You guys understand that. So, you know, all of the entertaining fights I had at the Blue Horizon, you know, I never thought that one day I would develop that name because you had so many great fighters fighting there before I even came along. So for me to end up with that title, with that name, is one of the most remarkable accomplishments that I incurred throughout my career.
I'm glad we didn't forget to ask you about it.
And I'm glad as well.
There you go, Tony.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it was always one of my favorite places to see a fight. I don't think I ever had the pleasure of seeing you fight there because when I started going, I don't think you were retired yet, but you were more fighting on the world title level at that time.
Sure.
And I never got to do a Tuesday night card there because it was hard because I was in college at the time.
Okay.
So whenever they had the Tuesday night shows, I was in school.
Every other month, I was at the Blue fight in the USA. Tuesday night fights, every other month. People got to see me throughout the world so many times because of me fighting continuously. Like I said, every other month, you've seen Rodney Moore on a card fighting some tough guy from another city, from another state, from another country. I was always in there with some very highly regarded opponents that most people didn't want to fight. USA came in because they knew this could be a good fight between these two guys, and every time I fought, they was there because it was always a fight where it could have went either way. So when I stepped in there, I fought some bad boys across the globe, and that's the only way you can develop that title. You had to have been in there. You had to have been doing some serious fighting, and you had to have been putting on some serious entertainment. And the most entertainment, you know, down I had was I pretty much won them all. You know what I mean? Pretty much won them all.
Yeah.
I incurred one loss at the Blue Horizon throughout my career, and the rest is history.
Well, you've been entertaining tonight. That's our 60-second warning. We're about to get cut off, so before we do,
thank you guys very much
for
the interview.
Awesome.
You guys take
care.
Thanks for having me on.
You too. You're welcome.
All right. You do as well.
Have a great night. Thanks.
Take care.
That's all for us. We're sign off now. We don't have Tom to do overtime, so.
Yeah. Well, Rich, thanks, and thanks for having Rodney on, and we'll talk next week.
Cool. Adios.
All right, see you later.
We talk a lot of folks, but hey, it is. We had a great interview. What do you want from us?
Absolutely. All right, talk to you later.
Adios.